Hello, friends. Welcome back, everybody, to Swan Signal Live. Here with my co-host, John, along with Q and Alec from the Swan Private Squad. Gentlemen, it's been, I'll just say, an historic week in this country. Difficult times. And you all may have read this book, The Fourth Turning, by Neil Howe. And there's a co-author too. Strauss is his last name. I can't think of his first name right now. Our friend Brandon Quittam, fellow Swan, wrote a great essay about this called Bitcoin and the Rhythms of History, about this book as it sort of relates to Bitcoin. And the premise of the book is that about every 80 to 100 years, societies face a great crisis. It's the collapse of the old order and the birth of something new. So that would, about 80 to 100 years ago, put us around World War II era, where a lot of new institutions were created in the wake of crumbling old institutions. And here we are now, about 80 plus years later, in a similar situation where violence erupts, assassinations, repression, upheaval, and violence, as history shows, does not kill ideas. It actually tends to spread them and accelerate them. I think there are a lot of people around the world, and certainly in this country, who have been exposed to Charlie Kirk's ideas, for instance, that were not before the tragedy happened this week. So this kind of violence really deepens the cracks in the institutions that are already rotting from within, and it's actually hastening their downfall. Faith in governments and corporations, religions, media, monetary systems are all crumbling under the weight of, and especially the monetary system, as we talk about all the time, under the weight of this endless debt and political corruption. So projects like Bitcoin and Nostr are building a new world based on decentralized open protocols and replacing gatekeepers as the foundation of a new world order, new institutions, decentralized institutions and protocols that will underlie this next turning. So it does certainly feel like a storm is upon us. It's felt like that for many years now. And so the question is, it's not whether or not, you know, change is coming. It's coming. It's what kind of world will we, you know, gather together and build on the other side of this, these crisis years, this storm. So we need Bitcoiners now more than ever, guys, to continue to step up and teach and advocate and build for this new world. So I would love to hear if you guys have any comments on this, and we can talk a little bit more about the fourth turning as well. I'll just open the floor and say, you know, welcome to the show. Thanks everyone for joining in and watching today. Happy to watch the chat to see if you guys have any comments to throw up. And John, I'll throw it over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Brady. Well said. And if I have a more somber tone today, it's for all the things you just mentioned and more. Still pretty shocked by that, the killing of Charlie Kirk, and other events, including a stabbing of an innocent girl on a train in Charlotte. There's a lot to say, and I don't think this is meant to be a podcast to unpack and talk about this all. But at the same time, it's probably something that's on nearly everybody's mind. It's certainly been on my mind for many days now. I think you highlighting the fourth turning is appropriate. I will tell people, if you want to learn more about it, you can type in Brandon Quittam's name to your favorite podcast search bar and probably find episodes a dozen times of him talking about it somewhere. He does a very good job.
I'll mention real quick, John, that's Bitcoin News, the Bitcoin News podcast, actually interviewed Brandon yesterday.
Okay, there you go.
So you got a fresh one to check out too, the Bitcoin News podcast.
There you go. So if you want the latest, it is very, very fresh. One thing I'll say is that I do this with older family members a good amount, and it's to discuss, I won't even say debate because it's not even really a debate, but just to discuss this question that I think can go on forever, and it will go on forever, of, are times crazier now, or are they, were they crazier at, you know, pick your decade in the past? And I'm a kid who grew up in the 90s. I don't think the 90s are thought of as a particularly crazy decade, but even if they were, the reason that a individual can't always evaluate this is because I was not following politics in the 90s. I was following Mets baseball and hockey and whatever else. So I can't really look back and say, even if I read up on the 90s and everything that happened, it's hard to look back and then for me to compare and say, was this crazier than 2025? Because I'm living through 2025. I'm almost 40 years old. Things mean more to me now. I have a family. So you can't always compare as an individual. So a lot of times you have to talk to someone who's older and say, hey, do you think the 60s were more crazy than today? Do you think the 70s were more crazy than today? You could wind back the clock. Obviously there've been world wars. The country's been through a civil war. There's plenty of people in this country that maybe have a grandparent who left a world war from Europe or some other country that was experiencing it and came to America. That's pretty crazy, right? You know, so you could always wind the clock back and get to something that appears crazier, but, the discussion that, I mean, you're not going to be able to debate with too many people who've been around for World War One or World War Two. So the discussion ends up being more like, hey, were the 60s and 70s crazier than today? And I'm not saying to have that discussion because there's a right answer, but I think people should have that discussion just for the sake of having the discussion with your older friends, family members. They can tell you what it was like, even if they weren't even in this country in the 60s or 70s, they could tell you what it was like where they were in the 60s or 70s. I think it gives you perspective. What you do with that perspective, of course, is up to you. And it's just good for the sake of open discussion, which is another reason why I think the Charlie Kirk shooting has gotten me so hard, is that plenty of people could disagree with his views, but there's just endless evidence that he was the guy who would have an open debate with you. And there were even people who, like, he vehemently disagreed with their political views, their lifestyle, their sexual orientation, whatever. They would literally get a microphone, be 10 feet away from him, and he would say something that was like very charitable and friendly. And he would even say, like, you know, my Christian religion causes me to disagree with your lifestyle or something like that. But it was never, people talk about him inciting hate and things like that. And I just don't think that's backed up by the evidence. So, and this last comment is kind of a crazy thing to say, or it feels like a crazy thing to say. There have been several attempts to kill presidents, and some of them have been successful. I'm not saying that makes it okay, but there's like a historical precedent for this in the US and basically every country on earth. But what makes this week's event so difficult is that this is not somebody who was, you know, setting policy and who was elected into office. This is literally a guy who was at an open debate event and got killed in that setting, which is just incredibly, incredibly a difficult pill to swallow. I'll stop there. I think there's more to say, but I'll stop there.
I will just chime in because this comment just came in on YouTube, and this was exactly where my head was at, from Jim Lynch, just kind of talking about I think part of the perspective that we have on today's day and age is warped because of everyone having a, you know, a camera that they can record and then send out whatever they're recording in real time to the entire world. And that I think shifts the perspective that, oh my God, there are so many horrible, bad things happening all throughout the world at once. When in reality, you know, back in the day in the 60s, like what, you got your news from the newspaper once a day, if that, and if the coverage was good enough, it covered enough stories. So I think that perspective, it's one that I pay attention to in these types of discussions. And then John, kind of to echo what you were saying a little bit as well, like, look, I did not agree with many of Charlie's beliefs, but I appreciated what he was doing. And what he was doing was creating a dialogue between people that sit on an opposing viewpoint. And in today's day and age, we have frankly lost that ability. And I am so grateful that he did what he was doing. And frankly, I hope that more people become emboldened to continue what he was doing, maybe not in a public sphere, but just in their private lives. I think that is the most important thing. And that's what I hope we really like latch onto here. Beyond that, it is like, I saw this commentary around it. Like, you know, we had the attempted assassination of Trump. What was that, like a year and a half ago now? And then you have this happen with Charlie Kirk. We're getting to a very uncomfortable, intense place in our country that, you know, in my lifetime, we weren't seeing anything of this magnitude. But then again, to point out Jim Lynch's comment, you know, in the 60s, you had JFK assassinated, you had MLK Jr. assassinated, you know, you have the war in Vietnam and protests going on about that on a regular basis. I'm not saying this time is better or worse, anything of the sort. I'm just saying in this cosm that we are right now, for us 90s babies and then Brady, what, you're a 70s, 80s baby? Like,
yeah, for, 79.
For all of us, like, we've not experienced this in our lifetime for the most part. Like, to watch presidents openly getting shot at, to watch, you know, public figures just getting gunned down in front of their family, just, you know, for talking, for exercising their First Amendment right. I think we're losing the plot a little bit.
I'll keep it short because you guys summed that up really well. I think the way I've thought about it is, you know, a lot of the takes I've seen online, I would just hope that this, you know, doesn't spread further hate and, you know, blaming of one side or the other. You know, the problem is much bigger than sides in politics. You know, there's tragedies all across the world. So it's, you know, it's a human problem, and we have systems that we're working with that are failing people. And that's ultimately where I believe all this strife and anger and hatred comes from. Because if we had systems that allowed everyone to prosper, you know, these types of events wouldn't, maybe they would still occur, but not as often, right? So that's the only thing I would say is I encourage everybody not to increase the hate, blame one side or the other, you know, have conversations, treat everyone as humans, and no matter what their beliefs are, you know, that's what it is at the end of the day. And, you know, we're here to talk about what's going to help us rebuild new systems, right?
Yeah, well said, man. And I think that, you know, if you have a disagreement with somebody about their ideas, even if you think their ideas are hateful in themselves, what do you want in a society when you have the collision of ideas, you know, directly opposing ideas, and you think that one idea is hateful, the other side might think your idea is hateful? Well, what do you want? You want someone who will sit down and engage with you in good faith and discuss calmly, rationally your ideas and do so respecting you as a person, even though they may fundamentally disagree with the way you live your life or how you identify or, And I had never seen anything from Charlie Kirk. I recognized his face. I couldn't have put the name to the face if I had just seen his face. But I have now watched some of his events and you know, from what I've seen, he was just that, doing just that, engaging in good faith, even with people who disagreed with his ideas, and not demeaning them as humans because they had an opposing idea. That's the kind of engagement that you want to have in a society where we are blessed with, you know, with free speech, or at least theoretically blessed with free speech, and in practice quite a bit, actually, compared to a lot of the rest of the world. So this idea of the fourth turning, I do encourage everyone to take a look at this book. I will share real quick Brandon's piece, if I can find the right one to show here. Yeah, let's see. Let me flip this. Yeah, so Bitcoin and the Rhythms of History at BrandonQuidham.com. Just search his name. And he's taken the ideas from this book, and I'll summarize them just a little bit more after this, but he's sort of applied them to a Bitcoin lens as well. So I definitely recommend this. There are podcasts of him talking about this idea as well, but this is a great kind of overview of the book itself, 50-minute read. I think Guy Swan has put it on his Bitcoin Audible podcast, if you're a person who likes to listen rather than read. You can check that out. So the fourth turning basically says there's these four turnings, these four events or sections. They call it a saeculum, which is roughly a human lifetime, 80 to 100 years. And they say that the cycle goes like this. And the first turning is a period of strengthening institutions. This is after the crisis, and declining individualism, followed by a societal crisis. That's the whole idea, right? So, and during this period, society tends to focus on community, conformity, and collective progress, with optimism and unity prevailing. The second turning is an awakening. It's characterized by spiritual and cultural upheaval, where individualism rises and institutions are challenged. There's a focus on personal authenticity, inner exploration, and rebellion against the conformity of the previous cycle, the previous high, the first turning. The third thing is the unraveling. Institutions weaken further as individualism triumphs, leading to cynicism, fragmentation, and culture of excess. Society experiences cultural decay, with trust in authorities eroding and personal freedoms emphasized. And then the fourth turning, which is where, you know, we're, you know, asserting that we are now, is the climactic phase, where society confronts a major existential threat, leading to the destruction of old institutions and the birth of new ones. Time of peril, mobilization, transformation, often involving war, economic collapse, or revolution. Historical examples include the Great Depression, World War II, the American Revolution, and the Civil War. So the authors predict that America's fourth turning is going to happen right about now. They predicted in the book between 2005 and 2025, so that 20-year period. And then it goes on to talk about the archetypes of people, the type of people that these 20-year periods generates. So in the first turning, you have prophets, idealists, visionaries, and visionary and principled. They lead awakenings and provide moral guidance in crises. The nomad is in the second period, pragmatic and individualistic. They endure unravelings and fight in crises. The hero, in the third turning, term-oriented and energetic, they build during highs and sacrifice in crises. And then finally, the artists, the sensitive and compromising, they support during awakenings and manage during highs. So these are the different types of people that these turnings produce. So interesting book. You can check it out. Maybe we can learn from the rhythms of history. And you can read in Brandon's essay about how Bitcoin fits into this fourth turning period that we're in now. Okay. Any other thoughts on fourth turning, gentlemen? Otherwise, we can proceed with some of the other Bitcoin and macro related news of the week.
Probably good to pivot to that.
Okay. All right, cool. Let's take a look at, well, first of all, we'll just start with this one. This is kind of a quick one, but it's a good chart for the macro scene. This is China seeking safety in bullion. This is their rising gold holdings piling on the dollar's failing hegemony. It says the top of this chart here, and you can see from 2001, actually, gold holdings apparently were basically flat from 1977 to 2001, and then they started stacking gold and have gone from about, let's see, 17 or 18. What's a troy ounce? 80 troy ounces. Is that a, that's, I don't know what that means, but they've basically, basically tripled, almost tripled, over tripled their, the amount of gold they've, they held from 2001 to now.
Yeah.
Almost quadruple. And
I view it as like a, this is a floor. This is probably the minimum, that they hold. Like, God, you know, they're not really known for transparency. So this, who knows if those numbers are right, but I would view it as they hold at least that much gold. There are people that have theories over there who are theories about what's going on in China, where they say, hey, they own way more than this. They're doing it through this entity in this offshore location, yada, yada, yada. So that could be happening, but I think the trend is clear. And yeah, we just wanted to highlight that. And the sources are the International Monetary Fund and Bloomberg. That's, so the sources are, I think, as good as you can get based on the information we have. But it's basically a good example of the fiat debasement trade. There are many people in on that trade. There's many people playing it different ways. And it obviously relates to Bitcoin in the sense that the dollar being a, or treasuries being a store of value, the dollar being this global hegemon is at least fading. We try not to be the people on here who say the dollar's hyperinflating, it's going to fail next Tuesday. That's not really our view. But it, the trends are weakening for sure that have been in place for the 40 years prior to 2020. So that's just another example of it.
Yeah, just, I mean, it's the start, right? No one's saying it's going to fail overnight, but this is highlighting it's neutral reserve assets seem to be the next step. Gold's the obvious one, and Bitcoin probably alongside that.
Yeah. Brady, can you throw the chart back up? I think actually the thing that I found most interesting of this, like truthfully, like we could have pulled this chart up at any point in the last 12 months, it seems, and sort of made this claim that their gold holdings have reached a new high. The most interesting thing to me is during the great financial crisis, that jump up where you see a roughly like 70, 80% increase in their holdings. And then again, you see a similar, if not greater jump around like 2015, 2016. I think those moments where they were just like pushing in versus what seems like the last few years, it's just been like a slow, steady increase. I think that's a bit more of the signal to me, at least, in that this shows a clear shift in their policy over the last, let's call it 24 months. They're just regularly, you know, they're dollar cost averaging into gold versus in these two other points in their history, they just said, all right, we have excess. We're going to put it in. We're not going to think about it again. From 2009 until about 2015, it looks like they didn't add to their gold holdings, and a similar trend from around 2017 to 2018, they didn't really add a whole lot there. Those are the breaking points for them. And I think the Great Financial Crisis started this trend, but now we've reached a point where they can't, you know, wait for the next mechanism to break and then go all in. They're just slowly and steadily going. And I think that's the most interesting part of this chart to me.
Yeah. What would it look like if the dollar were falling out of favor? You know, what's the Wittgenstein's, what would it look like if it looked like the dollar was falling out of favor? We would see things like that.
We would see things like Bitcoin taking off, and we would see things like China stacking gold. And eventually they'll be forced to stack sats. They should be doing it now. There's a couple of privacy related issues, from today or from this week. We had a supply chain attack on hardware wallet / signing devices. We can talk about that. Also, an attempt to fold cryptocurrencies into the privacy restricting aspects of the Patriot Act, which is still going strong. Nothing, more permanent than a temporary government program, right? And
the bank in the name of national security.
Yeah, exactly. Don't let any tragedy go unlevered. And then we have the Bank Secrecy Act. I'll play this clip of Warren Davidson talking about the Bank Secrecy Act. this week, and we'll start there.
Over decades, the BSA has morphed into a bloated surveillance machine, demanding endless reports from banks, businesses, and individuals without delivering proportional results. Today, this framework is dangerously outdated, and the BSA's one-size-fits-all mandates are tying up lots of resources. Are they being used effectively? In recent years, the Bank Secrecy Act, Corporate Transparency Act, Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020 have proven sometimes ineffective, but always cumbersome. For example, FinCEN's own data shows that from 2014 to 2023, law enforcement agencies only accessed about 5.4% of the millions of currency transaction reports filed under the Bank Secrecy Act, highlighting how this flood of paperwork buries real leads in bureaucracy instead of focusing on bad actors.
Okay. So yeah, Davidson's here talking about the Bank Secrecy Act and its inefficiencies. I know Jan Pritzker, our CTO and co-founder, has talked about this subject as well, particularly focused on KYC and AML laws and how they're actually completely ineffective. So they're way more effective at surveying the American citizens and much less effective at preventing crime and terrorism as they are purported to do. And as he stated there, only 5.4% of the reports that have been generated by the Bank Secrecy Act, you know, basically where did this money come from, kind of stuff, have been used by law enforcement. There are better ways that we could go about doing this, including getting warrants for such information. Would be a good returning to that would probably be a good idea. So it's great to see this kind of commentary happen in a hearing on Capitol Hill. Not confident that we'll see any serious reform here, and we'll take a look at that Patriot piece here in a minute, which really makes me is the reason for my doubt there. Not the only reason, obviously, but anything here on the Bank Secrecy Act, guys, KYC, AML, and reporting all of the source of income, stuff like that, which we deal with all the time. Obviously, we interface with the legacy financial system, trying to help people bring money out of that system and into Bitcoin. So to do that, we have to interface with the banking system, and we have to follow certain laws as well, which we certainly do not like.
Okay, yeah, that's just I wanted to chime in real quick on that and just go on the record and say all of us at Swan Private, when we bother our clients, so I'm specifically talking to my clients who are listening, who get mad whenever they get that POSOF. Yeah. This is not an us thing. We are just trying to comply by the laws that are, you know, in place, unfortunately. So I just wanted to go on record to just reiterate that and then let it return to the group to comment.
Yeah,
I think the only adage that comes to mind is it's guilty until proven innocent, not what it should be, innocent until proven guilty, which it's just wrong.
Yeah, it's definitely not philosophically aligned with it. I mean, if I tried to give the other side the benefit of the doubt, it's like maybe at the beginning of instituting these rules, you would say, okay, maybe they'll be great. But like now they've been around for 50 years, and I'm sure they would argue, they would say, here's what it's done. Like it stopped this, it stopped that. You never really hear those arguments. Like they never really make a good case for the Bank Secrecy Act. It's always like not real evidence-based. It's always like just like, hey, we're stopping terrorism, or hey, we're stopping bad guys. Meanwhile, you know, 99.9% of the people that they're collecting information on are not bad guys, and you just create a huge honeypot, and then it's a privacy and a security issue for people. We'll see where the clip goes. Who knows, right? It could be some guy just like floating a trial balloon and maybe putting it somewhere, and it doesn't get traction with enough politicians. But I would say it's at least hopeful that someone is making these statements about the BSA. I believe it's the BSA that had the $10,000 limit, where it was like any cash transaction of $10,000 over $10,000 has to be like reported and documented and all this stuff. Most Bitcoiners have probably heard this, but I'll just say it again. That was started at some point in the early 70s when $10,000 was like, you know, you could probably buy two cars or like three cars that in the 1970s. It's probably maybe $90,000 to $100,000 today. So imagine you're paying somebody $90,000 cash for something. If they adjusted that with inflation, they would not be doing nearly as much data collection. And maybe that would be more tolerable for people if it was like, hey, if you're anything under 90K in cash, you don't have to report. Like, that's what it started as in terms of purchasing power. But they don't change it. So over time, the purchasing power threshold of 10,000 obviously is just capturing lower and lower dollar amounts. So there's many logical reasons to update this stuff or just get rid of some of the restrictions entirely.
I always just like to bring up these two main points whenever this, the anti-money laundering laws and all of this just gets brought up, or, you know, the age old FUD of, oh, Bitcoin's used by criminals, it's used by whatever. Whenever you see those pictures from, you know, the police finally catching the crooks, you don't see Bitcoin wallets, you see stacks of cash or gold. All right, first and foremost, let's nip that in the bud right then and there. But also, and I will never stop laughing about this, everyone, I'm talking about you, Elizabeth Warren, who I know watches Swan Signal live every week. So this, I'm talking directly to you, Miss Warren. You know, when everything was heating up between Palestine and Israel starting in 2023, there were these loud claims that, oh, Hamas is using crypto to fund its like operations. And then Hamas came out with a statement saying, hey guys, don't send us crypto, because it's easily traceable and it doesn't actually affect us. Like, if once you send it to us, like, we're good. Like, if we wanted to use it, we can. But if you send it, you're going to be in trouble. So don't send us crypto. So to go back to, you know, the question of, we've never seen anyone come out and say like, oh, you know, we have actually caught people using these laws. It's actually the terrorist organizations that we say we're trying to prevent are the ones coming out and saying, don't use cryptocurrency because you will get caught. It's not the government saying we've caught people using it. So just, you know, that's the context of all of this that I always love to just, you know, throw in there. You're muted, Alec.
Oh, I just said that's interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
So Grok says, I asked Grok if, the BSA was effective at stopping crime, and was it effective at surveilling American citizens? And Grok says there's limited measurable impact, kind of following what Warren Davidson said. High volume, low utility. So the millions of reports overwhelm agents, obscuring genuine threats and reducing overall effectiveness. Let's see. And then resource drain without proportional gains. Targeted successes, but systemic failures. And I think all of those really hit the spot, in my opinion. Is it effective at surveilling American citizens? Yes, there's broad warrantless data collection. The BSA mandates bulk reporting of financial data. As John said, anything over $10,000, any suspicious activities for over $5,000, as the SAR reports. Weaponization for political and non-criminal monitoring. The FBI has pressured banks via FinCEN to file SARs on hundreds of Americans based on vague suspicious criteria, again, without warrants, privacy erosion and overreach, ineffective safeguards. So I think it's a bad law. I think it's a bad law for a lot of reasons at this point, and it has failed. So it's a tool of surveillance, and that kind of power is rarely rescinded or given up easily by the government, as is evidenced by the Patriot Act. It's been around since 9/11. The government is moving to bring Patriot Act regulations to digital assets. The FinCEN director reveals that the Treasury is finalizing a ban on privacy tools. This week seems to be the week of revisiting, this is from the article, of revisiting useless legislation that turned fatal for the constitutional rights of U.S. Americans while proving lethal for many non-U.S. citizens.
Well, we are happy to report the Treasury is working on reforming the Bank Secrecy Act yesterday, signed into law by President Richard Nixon in 1970. This 9/11 anniversary, we have to report that the Treasury is working on applying the Patriot Act to digital assets. So interesting, one day after the other, these two reports. So one step forward, possibly another big step back in the next day.
Yeah. And that's where I feel like the fact that we just brought up both of these news items shows that it's really hard to make too much out of one of these things. Like none of this is law. It's like they're looking to do this or looking to roll this back. And it's going to take a lot of time before any of this becomes real.
I also think, though, that, and this might be my understanding, and if someone here doesn't agree with this, like, would love to hear the other side of it, but it feels like this is a very direct call out to like mixer softwares, which we've actually been seeing for the last few years. We've seen, you know, software developers and people who essentially created these mixers where you would send your coins, it would get mixed, and then you essentially could circumvent KYC as a result of using it. That feels like the most direct target by this measure on the Patriot Act. And if that is the case, that we've already seen through their actions, not their words, that governments are taking aggressive action against those types of softwares.
I think mixers are always going to be in their crosshairs, just for the record. I feel like that's going to be target number one for them. But there was something in the screenshot, and granted, I have not fully looked into what's being contemplated here, but there was something in there that had a bullet about creating and using single-use wallets, addresses, or accounts, and sending cryptocurrency through such wallets or addresses or accounts through a series of independent transactions. Like, they're just calling out single-use wallets, and addresses. That's just a Bitcoin address. Like, right. So again, none of this is official, and who knows who it got written by. It could have been some staffer who doesn't even know what they're talking about, and the decision makers like barely understand it or haven't even read it. But it's one of those things where it's like, okay, this is their opening salvo. Like, we got to be careful, because if this were to pass, like, that this would have dramatic effects on Bitcoin.
You're telling me that the government that enacts laws does so on technologies that they don't understand properly?
Or passes bills that they've never read? Yes.
What?
Both of those things.
That's crazy. Who would hold those people accountable?
You guys summed it up well. It just shows a lack of understanding. I mean, maybe some of this is more applicable to other cryptocurrencies, but I don't know how you prevent me from using a single-use address or wallet. It's just, you know, there's going to be roundabout ways that exist if people want to do it. So it doesn't seem super applicable to Bitcoin. It's just going to make it more difficult to use, right?
And hopefully they realize that and they say this is a losing game. Because they don't just have full unilateral control to implement any law that they want, right? Yeah. There are some restrictions on these people. So that's a good point, Alec.
So the Samurai issue comes to mind. The two developers of the Samurai wallet, which was a non-custodial Bitcoin privacy app, used CoinJoin mixing for anonymity. So you basically... Mixer is just what it says. You put lots of UTXOs together and mix them around and then output them into different UTXOs to make chain analysis less effective at, you know, tracing where the money's gone on the blockchain. And the DOJ alleged that it enabled $100 million plus in laundered funds from crimes like dark web sales and hacks, and facilitated over $2 billion in transactions without AML KYC. They pled not guilty this summer, arguing that the non-custodial nature exempts it from money service businesses rules, MSB rules, which I think is part of the Bank Secrecy Act, actually, per FinCEN guidelines. Again, maybe it's not in the act. Maybe it's just a FinCEN guideline. So that's where they are now. Here we go. The money laundering charge was dropped. And then they pled guilty to unlicensed transmitting conspiracy, agreed to forfeit, some money. and including $6.3 million in personal money. And their trial is set for November 3rd, sentencing for November 7th. So this is just an example, I think probably the most high profile example recently of the government going after privacy tools, Bitcoin privacy tools. All right. Let's hit this supply chain attack real quick. So this week, a large-scale supply chain attack that was targeting NPM, which is the repository management for code, like open source code. And there are many, you know, thousands, millions of open source libraries, this code, the bits of code that are used in larger applications, like a puzzle piece kind of, and they plug in so that, you know, the coders don't have to kind of reinvent the wheel. And they've got a great, you know, thing that they can plug in here to accomplish this, this create this feature, this service, right? And that system of maintaining all of those libraries, those bits of code, was compromised. The account of a reputable developer, so it was just one account that was compromised and affected code packages that have already been downloaded over 1 billion times. So these dependencies, they're called, these apps have dependencies on this open source code. And so these apps will automatically download all of these dependencies behind the scenes and incorporate them into the app. So that means there's, you know, millions of apps out there that use, you know, tens of thousands, whatever it is, hundreds of thousands of these pieces of code. And those automatically get downloaded anytime an app that uses those open source pieces of code is used. So we're all have downloaded this, you know, pieces of these NPM libraries, you know, all the time as we're updating apps. So it puts the entire JavaScript ecosystem at, maybe at risk. And so effectively, if you're using, if you have a hardware wallet, you should use a hardware wallet, right? To store and move your funds. If you have a hardware wallet, you can check the addresses on the device itself. And the, you know, the code, the malicious code is not on the hardware device, it's on your computer. That's why we use the hardware devices, the signing devices, so that malicious code is separated, you know, separated from the actual device itself, right? So you can confirm the addresses on your device. What will happen with this code, basically, if you're just using a software wallet on your laptop, they can switch out addresses without you even noticing. And therefore send your Bitcoin to a different address when you think you're sending it to one address, to another one of your addresses or whomever. So hardware wallets will protect you from this this compromise. I would stay away for a while from using software wallets on your laptops for now. This will be patched. So
I think one thing to know, cut you off, John. I did post for you, Brady. Charles came out with another post, kind of an update saying the attack fortunately has failed with almost no victims. I think there was like apparently, you know, it was pretty easily detectable. So a lot of folks have been able to identify, and essentially most of it was code targeted web crypto activity, hooking into Ethereum and Solana and other chains to hijack transactions, essentially what you covered. But sounds like Bitcoin was a more difficult target for them, and it was pretty easy to identify when this exploit, or what you would call it, was used. So that's good news.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I had not seen that follow-up, so that's great.
Awesome. What Alec was going to say is definitely more important than what I was going to say. This is PSA for using hardware wallets. Always trust what's on the screen of your hardware wallet over anything that's on the screen of your software computer interface that you're using. We generally believe Bitcoin-only hardware wallets are going to be incrementally better than a wallet that has support for a whole bunch of other tokens. And you can see there were a bunch of, you know, whether it's Blockstream Jade or other companies came out and said, hey, they came out pretty quickly and they were like, hey, our device is unaffected by this. I think it was a pretty good PR job response by different companies out there. Also, if you just like, if you're a long-term holder and you see something like this, the best thing to do is not send a transaction, right? Like that's a good security measure right there. If you're worried that for some reason, the software, the hardware you're using is compromised, the best thing to do is wait.
Yeah, I would just kind of echo all of this. I had a client actually like reach out to me about this, sending this tweet, essentially worried that their Bitcoin wasn't safe. And I had to like walk them through, like, this is a wallet issue. Like, if your biggest concern is that you might be compromised, the best thing actually to do right now is, to John's point, let's not send any Bitcoin around for a second while this gets sorted. And then sure enough, like everything is all good. I think the bigger point that I kind of want to make on this is, you know, we're going to see more of these types of malicious attacks across the crypto space, the higher prices go, because the incentive is going to be there for these scammers and hackers to try to steal Bitcoin. And I'm more worried about Bitcoin because that's all I've got. So that's just, I think, a gentle reminder to stay vigilant and stay aware of what's going on out there.
Yep.
Real-time PSA, Brady, real quick.
Here we go.
Okay. I was going to say one thing before you do that. Yeah. There's a Blockstream email. Jimmy Song posted this like today. There's a Blockstream email saying, hey, there's a firmware update available. Download this version. Don't ever do that. Just don't ever trust these emails claiming to be your hardware wallet provider, claiming to be Swan, claiming to be Coinbase, claiming to be Google. Don't ever trust it. Assume it's a scam until proven otherwise.
Yeah, what we like to say is, if you have any questions, just write in with an approved like business contact form or an email address with the business's domain name, or call the business to confirm if you have any doubts, whether any communication. But in general, Swan's not going to proactively send information asking for your account information, or send emails or communications asking for your account information. Not going to happen. If you ever have any doubt, just call us, write into our client support team, et cetera. Contact your rep. So we do have a collaborative self-custody solution that gives you two hardware signing devices. And then you have a third key that is maintained by Swan, connected to your Swan account, that you can use to sign transactions. So you have two hardware devices, you put them in two different locations, geographically separated locations. And if you want to send transactions, you can get one of your hardware wallets and use your cloud key and your Swan account to authorize transactions with two of the keys. Two out of three keys are required. And you always want to keep those two hardware wallets separated. However, if anything ever happens to Swan, you always have the two hardware devices, so you're always in complete control of your money. This is a nice way to get into self-custody. You get a nice multi-signature setup, so it's not relying on just one key or one hardware device. And you also have Swan to kind of back you up, help with the setup, make sure everything's operating smoothly. And if you ever have any issues, you can, contact our support team or your Swan private rep. So I think it's a really good way to do self-custody. I use it. You maintain full control of your Bitcoin, but you have the peace of mind of having Swan there to help you out. We use Blockstream Jades. You can see here how it actually works. You've got to have two out of the three keys to broadcast a transaction. We put a 72-hour security hold on it, so it actually doesn't go out for 3 days. You can override that by using your two keys together if you need to do it faster. But when you use the Swan key, you get an extra layer of protection. With your cloud key, you get an extra layer of protection with this 72-hour hold. So it's a pretty great deal to protect your money. So if you have a serious amount of your wealth in Bitcoin, certainly worth the price, in my opinion, to set up a Swan vault. So you can contact us about that. We'd be happy to help you get that all set up and get you some self-custody. All right, let's take a look at the next hit here. We have Tether dropping a new coin, USAT, a new stable coin. USDT is the coin that that they launched many years ago. They were, I think, the first stablecoin provider. And now they are launching USAT, which is an American regulated stablecoin. I think that means that if you're using Tether in the United States, you'll need to use the USAT Tether, or at least they'll try to make that happen. And let's see, let's watch this little ad for it, just to give you a taste of how they're positioning things, and we can react to it after we watch it.
In 2014, Tether created something the world had never seen, the first stablecoin, a digital dollar. For the first time, millions gained fast, borderless access to dollars. Not through banks, but through code. USDT changed the way money moves. 24/7, without friction, without permission. Now, we're bringing that same invention home, to the US. To the builders, the creators, the earners, those who've been left behind for far too long. Meet USAT, the stablecoin made for Americans. Fast, stable, and backed one-to-one with liquid and stable reserves. Because Tether didn't just invent stablecoins. We built a system to put dollars in your hands, instantly, and in your control. Tether, powering dollars for the next generation.
USAT. All right. So this is how Tether is positioning USAT. It's kind of a patriotic angle here, and also focused on the younger demographic as the new way to deal with dollars. So here we are. Is this effectively, John, is this effectively a CBDC in your opinion?
Ooh, yeah. That's, debated within the Bitcoin community. I would say a stable coin with a like it's going to be centralized by definition. And if that centralized entity is willing to take action at the behest of a government, or even if they signal that they're not willing to, but they can, right? Like they might change their mind a day from now, a year from now. It's I would almost compare it to kind of like the existing system. The existing system, if the government wants JP Morgan to like stop payments or do something like that, they can't just like press a button and make it happen. So if we had like a true CBDC where the government is the issuer of the token and they control it, it's like, you know, instant. They would be able to just stop a payment, freeze somebody, eliminate them from the system. In the current system, it's still like walled gardens and the government gets to ultimately decide what happens. But there are more frictions in place. Like they're supposed to go through the legal system. There's courts, there's supposed to be appeals and things like that. So that's kind of what I view the stable coins as, like more akin to the existing system. There is a little bit more friction than if it was just a true CBDC, but I suppose one could argue that maybe the stable coin is a little bit closer to a true CBDC than the existing system, just because it's probably just going to be quicker for the government to like hit the pause button or the freeze button. That's kind of where I come down on it.
It kind of ties back to the Bank Secrecy Act and Patriot Act stuff, right? Because what does a stablecoin give us on top of the existing dollar, right? This one's US-based. Like stablecoins have helped spread the dollar globally, but this one's focused just for the United States. So cross that one out. Two would be speed. Yeah, it's going to be nicer to be able to move dollars faster than ACH and wire transfers are a pain. If you've done those, everybody knows, nobody likes it. So, you know, there is a benefit to users from that standpoint, but there's also the programmability aspect. And that's where I think some of these rules from the Bank Secrecy Act can literally be programmed, you know, forced to be programmed right into that. So that's the one side of it where it's a big question mark is how far do they push some of the rules and programming onto this digital dollar. That's we'll have to wait and see what comes out of that.
So I think there's another thing that I think I'm stealing this from the All In podcast, but David Sachs was talking about this, and I think this is actually the interesting part about this iteration of stablecoins. And it's about the fact that now the Treasury and the Federal Reserve has artificially created a new buyer of US debt. And going back to that chart that we saw with China's gold holdings, as well as just the general sentiment globally for U.S. debt by foreign nations, that desire, that demand has diminished over the last 5 years in particular, in a way that the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. dollar is not ready to handle. So what we've essentially created is a backstop for U.S. Treasuries with a company like Tether that was already buying U.S. Treasuries to begin with, but now is forced to create and spin up a new stablecoin and purchase more U.S. Treasuries as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that to me is actually the most telling part of this is it's sure. You guys are absolutely right. There will come a point where this becomes programmable. This will become a version of a central bank digital currency. If you piss off someone, it won't be very difficult for the government to go to Tether and say, hey, Alec can't use his USDTA or whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
To a degree, though, they could actually just do that right now. They could call up Bank of America with a warrant and say, hey, Alec can't use Bank of America anymore. So that side of it will come to pass. I firmly believe it. Just historically speaking, you guys are right there. The present moment, the signal to me is the U.S. government did find their backstop. They found their sucker to keep buying U.S. treasuries, and that sucker is Tether.
And that leads us into the implications of the Genius Act. So less than 5% of the stablecoin reserve market is, for Tether, is Bitcoin. So they have, let's see, cash and cash equivalents is a huge part of it. What is this giant dark? I don't see this in the key.
I think that's their actual like USDT. So it's like,
oh, I see. Yeah, it's left and right. So it's like, yeah. So this is the backing here. 81% is cash equivalents, short-term deposits. Then you have corporate bonds, precious metals, Bitcoin, other investment secured loans make up the rest. In the Genius Act, apparently it's restricting stable coins from using non-US government short duration debt for reserves. And this will start in 18 months, meaning that basically you can only hold treasuries and equivalents. So they're U.S. government short duration debt. That's it. So the Genius Act saying like, okay, just what Q is saying, we got to find more people, more institutions to buy treasuries because they're becoming less and less attractive for large institutions and nations as collateral and as savings. So the Genius Act is making that part of the law where you basically have to hold treasuries to back your stable coins in the United States, which also means that Tether may have to unload 5% or a bunch of Bitcoin or move that over to their own corporate treasury. I guess they could hold on to it that way and then replace that 5% of their backing with U.S. government short duration debt. So, John, any thoughts here on what that might mean in 18 months and the implications here? Another example of the U.S. kind of trying to take over, regulate the stablecoin market in this country.
Yeah, I think it is going to head that direction. They're just going to say, hey, these are now approved and fully legal U.S. digital dollars, but because of that, the reserves just have to be treasuries, short-term treasuries. That they've kind of already done this in the money market world. If anyone has a history with TradFi or has had some other reason to look into this, there was a point in time when corporate bonds were pretty widespread in money market funds, and everyone just treated that like cash with a little bit of yield. It would be short-dated commercial paper in the money market funds. But there was like periods of instability and there were periods of risk that there would be defaults and, oh my gosh, this thing that people just treated as money good is now going to, take a haircut or take a loss. And, then you get financial crises and panic and all this kind of stuff. And then as always, the government steps in and, makes some sort of change. Now money market funds are almost like exclusively U.S. government debt, short dated. So I think you're seeing a similar thing here. I'm not surprised. I think the outcome of this is just that, Tether keeps on growing and they stack Bitcoin, but they use it with that coupon that they're clipping. They just take it and then stack Bitcoin for themselves, and the Bitcoin doesn't serve as reserves anymore. Yep. So that's where I see this going.
Could also be why they're, you know, creating a separate one for the US specifically, right? I don't know the exact details of this. If it's going to impact USDT, you know, that already exists, you know, do they have to get rid of this Bitcoin? Are they going to be able to keep that? Is this just going to apply to the USAT? You know, I still have some questions there, but yeah, agree with everything you said.
Yeah, I think too, essentially the fact that, you know, right now, if you hold USDT, you could get some form, or you could have been getting some form of interest payment. You won't be able to with USAT or whatever the new version is. But Tether, in theory, will be making money off of your US dollar deposit when they then go and buy a treasury. So whatever their return is on those treasury notes either will be reinvested into purchasing more treasury, which would then allow them to issue more tokens, or, to John's point, which I fundamentally agree with, at the core thesis of them, they will just purchase more Bitcoin and hold it for themselves.
It's also another really good point with the, I believe the banks lobbied, so US stable coins couldn't offer an interest rate on holding the tokens. I wonder, do the other ones that will offer interest, are we going to be banned from using that? You know, that's
my understanding was it was the small, like the local mom and pop type banks. They were the ones that very aggressively lobbied against allowing stablecoin issuers to offer interest. And the thesis that I've heard discussed is, out the gate, no stable coins will be able to get, like Circle, you can't get interest if you hold Circle. But the thesis is what they're trying to do is give these smaller banks time to issue their own form of a stable coin. And then once sort of everyone has gotten theirs, then they may revisit this idea of no interest on stable coins.
Interesting.
It's crazy, you know, instead of just letting a competitive landscape and free market dictate what the people actually want, need, and will use, we have to create these sort of, as I like to call them, sort of like, I'm spacing on the word right now, but like legal trenches or legal walls to protect institutions that have existed just because they haven't kept up or have not frankly offered a product that is competitive enough to stay relevant in the marketplace.
Totally.
Brady looks so serious right now.
Frozen?
He might be frozen. I was either he's yeah, he's frozen because he's so serious and like still.
Very stoic looking there.
he's really upset with me about my takes right now. Still frozen, Brady.
I could do some quick hits while Brady is maybe coming back. I don't think we hit on the fact that last... Oh, Brady, are you... Brady, apparently he's able to change the screen here. And that is literally where I was going to go. So we were on the show last Friday. MicroStrategy was going to get the announcement after the market closed of whether they get into the S&P 500. They did not get in. For anyone just following along here, S&P 500, it is roughly 500 companies. They have some guidelines of what gets a company in. You have to meet certain criteria, but then it's not just purely formulaic. There's a committee that decides if you get in or not. Three other companies got in, not MicroStrategy. I think the next one is in December, the next chance that they might get into the S&P 500. So that's just a quick hit there. Also wanted to talk about just kind of macro economy wise. For the second year in a row, there was a big BLS revision that basically said 900,000 fewer jobs were created between April 24 and March of 2025. This is a huge reminder. Anytime you see jobs data, it's portrayed as, oh, they must just be counting the number of jobs that were created in this particular time, right? This is an objective exercise. I wish it were like that. It is not like that. They do some counting of jobs that are visible, but for the most part, they do a lot of assumptions that go into this. They try to interpret and extrapolate what might have been created. There's this one thing called the birth death factor, if you want to look into it. But as you can see here, over time, it ends up being revealed that they got the numbers quite wrong. So that has come out. This could be one of those things where bad economic news ends up being good for asset prices. I kind of hate that conceptually, but that's the world we live in. So where people are kind of thinking is that this might cause the Fed to be incrementally more likely to cut rates in September. I think it's next week. So that's where the market kind of is. Maybe Bitcoin's responding to that a little bit. It's at 116K 500 right now. And then also Bessent was kind of on TV earlier this week talking about these revisions. And he did have kind of the message of saying, hey, the economy we inherited was not so good. So that was a big story this week that we wanted to highlight. Otherwise, I will also point out that Gemini is now a publicly traded company. That's another Bitcoin and unfortunately crypto related stock. But the number of, at least they do some Bitcoin related activities, the number of Bitcoin and crypto related companies in the public markets is growing. I think the positive interpretation is that these are interests that will defend Bitcoin to a certain extent. I don't think they're fully aligned with the Bitcoin community by any means. They're going to confuse people with crypto marketing and nonsense and things like that, but it's not all bad. I think having companies that serve the Bitcoin community being public is at least partially a good thing.
I do think I want to go back really quickly to the MicroStrategy inclusion. I would love to bet either of you or anyone, I'm not going to eat a shoe, pee, but like, you know, a simple water bet, like loser of the bet gets a bucket of water poured on them. I will take the side that MicroStrategy does not get included in December. And I'd even go so far as to say, I think it would take a bear market and stability in Bitcoin's price for the S&P to include MicroStrategy in the S&P 500.
I'm not taking the other side of that. I don't think, yeah. I mean, if you listen to Saylor, he was not thinking they would be included like at all. So I think people get excited about these things, but there's hundreds of companies that qualify that don't get included, right? They swap a couple each time.
So, okay. John?
Yeah, maybe I should have said, you guys saying Saylor just reminded me, I'll just say earlier at the start of this week, I was at a conference. There's an investment bank in New York that Saylor did a keynote speech at. It was just him speaking and doing slides. So I got to see the man in action. Someone out there on Twitter said that the latest presentation was pitching MicroStrategy as more of a Bitcoin capital markets play. And this is kind of an interesting one because, I mean, if you follow the STR, FCKD instruments, he's kind of been doing this, but it's getting, it's getting pitched different ways. And we keep coming up with analogies of what MicroStrategy is doing, but he had a really good presentation that just kind of said what each instrument is, what investor market it's going after, what is the yield of this MicroStrategy instrument, what's the Bitcoin coverage of this instrument, and what's the yield of the comparable security. And I think we're in the early innings of this. I don't think institutional investors are all going to switch over from corporate bonds to, you know, these MicroStrategy securities overnight. But over time, I think people are going to look at them and say, hey, based on the kind of security and asset coverage that these instruments have, where they sit in the capital structure, what's the yield, what's the comparable yield I can get elsewhere, I think you are going to see institutional capital shift into these instruments. And the more that institutional capital shifts in, the more that they can issue, and the more that more Bitcoin they can buy. If Bitcoin keeps going up, the more they can issue. It kind of is a self-reinforcing flywheel. I don't think it goes in the same direction forever, unless Bitcoin's price goes up forever, which obviously is not going to be the case. There will be ups and downs, but this is going to be a trend that I think we're going to see for a long, long time of MicroStrategy getting a larger market cap, more Bitcoin, larger Bitcoin value, more financial instruments issued, and so on and so on and so on. So yeah, thank you guys for bringing up Sailor. I wanted to mention that.
Totally.
We had Brady back for a second. We may have lost him. I'm the captain now. We're already over an hour and 10 minutes here. Brady, if you're back, you may have come in, but you kind of look frozen or choppy here. Yeah, we may not get anything from Brady.
But yes, yeah, the software bug that I sent to Brady, he clearly clicked the malicious link.
He fell for it. So, all right, guys, we're going to wrap it there. Brady did the shout out for Swan Private. So we kind of covered that. We covered the PSA of do not click malicious links, even if it looks like Q is emailing you with a non-suspicious link. And last thing I will say, if you're looking for some listening over the weekend, Lynn Alden joined the podcast Impact Theory with the host whose name Tom Bilyeu, which I think is cool for a couple of reasons. One, it is Lynn, who I really never tire of hearing her speak. I think she's one of the best communicators and analysts out there. And I think it's also cool that she went on this show, which is not at all a Bitcoin show. This guy has, you know, a big following, which is awesome, but it's not a Bitcoin show. So her getting out the message of broken money and Bitcoin being a solve for it, I think is really cool. So check that one out if you're looking for something this weekend. And I'll turn it to you guys. Anything you want to close with?
Keep stacking sats. I think we got some exciting months ahead. That's it. Same message as always.
And for my degenerate, it was only week one. You know, we'll turn around. It's a long fantasy football season. We did not. We should do that though, John.
Okay, BTC and DC. There's always something. We're approaching quickly. In my head, months ago, I was like, September 30th. That's so far away. It's no longer far away. September 30th and October 1st. This is BTC and DC. It's going to be a very cool conference. No disrespect for the really large conferences that are out there. They're cool in their own right. This is going to be a smaller conference with a lot of signal, really good speakers. You'll probably get to chat it up with the speakers. You'll run into the same attendees, get to have really good conversations. So would highly recommend if you can get to Washington, DC, September 30th and October 1st are the two dates of that conference. Check out the speakers if you want to see, but it's going to be Sailor and a bunch of other people speaking there, as well as some potential, you know, lawmakers in the Bitcoin space. And then lastly, the show is brought to you by Mara, world's largest publicly traded Bitcoin miner, keeping the Bitcoin network secure. And I think we will wrap it there. So thank you everybody for joining. Touch grass is probably an important message to end on here, given the events of this week. And thanks again. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye, everybody.